out of mind, but there's not much to say. Sometimes the silence guides the mind to move to a place so far away. The goosebumps start to race the minute that my left hand meets your waist. And then I watch your face, put my finger on your tongue, cause you love the taste, yeah. These hearts adore everyone the other beats hardest for. Inside this place is warm.
There is a question that has been tossed around by philosophers and art critics for decades. How much should an artist's intention affect your interpretation of the work? Do the artist's plans and motivations affect its meaning? Or is it completely up to the judgment of the viewer? I'm Katerina Badzaiki. Welcome to this week's infinitely curious program of ERTH and The Voice of Greece. Today, we will explore the complex web of artistic interpretation. The idea came to my mind when, on a weekday morning, I visited the new Neo-Impressionism exhibition at my favorite Ulandris Museum in Pagrati. I believe that nothing boosts our creativity more than visiting art galleries and museums. And this is my thing when I have time to meditate on art. But gazing at works of French painters like Paul Signac, Henri Edmond Cros and Theo van Rijsselberghe, I couldn't help thinking, why am I so attracted to those airy colours, dappled brushstrokes and sparkling light-infused landscapes? Why does the painting of a woman without seeing her face makes me emotional and blows my mind? Does this art speak to me in the same way as for someone else? And why is that we are seeing different things when two people are looking at the same painting? Hayley Levitt attempts to answer, who decides what art means?
Imagine you and a friend are strolling through an art exhibit and a striking painting catches your eye. The vibrant red appears to you as a symbol of love, but your friend is convinced it's a symbol of war. And where you see stars in a romantic sky, your friend interprets global warming-inducing pollutants. To settle the debate, you turn to the internet, where you read that the painting is a replica of the artist's first-grade art project. Red was her favourite colour, and the silver dots are fairies. You now know the exact intentions that led to the creation of this work. Are you wrong to have enjoyed it as something that the artist didn't intend? Do you enjoy it less now that you know the truth? Just how much did the artist's intention affect your interpretation of the painting? It's a question that's been tossed around by philosophers and art critics for decades, with no consensus in sight. In the mid-20th century, literary critic W.K. Wimsett and philosopher Monroe Beardsley argued that artistic intention was irrelevant. They called this the intentional fallacy, the belief that valuing an artist's intentions was misguided. Their argument was twofold. First, the artists we study are no longer living, never recorded their intentions, or are simply unavailable to answer questions about their work. Second, even if there were a bounty of relevant information, Wimsett and Beardsley believed that it would distract us from the qualities of the work itself. They compared art to a dessert. When you taste a pudding, the chef's intentions don't affect whether you enjoy its flavour or texture. All that matters, they said, is that the pudding works. Of course, what works for one person might not work for another. And since different interpretations appeal to different people, the silver dots in our painting could be reasonably interpreted as fairies, stars, or pollutants. By Wimsett and Beardsley's logic, the artist's interpretation of her own work would just be one among many equally acceptable possibilities. If you find this problematic, you might be more in line with Stephen Knapp and Walter Ben Michaels, two literary theorists who rejected the intentional fallacy. They argued that an artist's intended meaning was not just one possible interpretation, but the only possible interpretation. For example, suppose you're walking along a beach and come across a series of marks in the sand that spell out a verse of poetry. Knapp and Michaels believed the poem would lose all meaning if you discovered these marks were not the work of a human being, but an odd coincidence produced by the waves. They believed an intentional creator is what makes the poem subject to understanding at all. Other thinkers advocate for a middle ground, suggesting that intention is just one piece in a larger puzzle. Contemporary philosopher Noel Carroll took this stance, arguing that an artist's intentions are relevant to their audience, the same way a speaker's intentions are relevant to the person they're engaging in conversation. To understand how intentions function in conversation, Carol said to imagine someone holding a cigarette and asking for a match. You respond by handing them a lighter, gathering that their motivation is to light their cigarette. The words they use to ask the question are important, but the intentions behind the question dictate your understanding and ultimately your response. So which end of this spectrum do you lean towards? Do you, like Wimser and Beardsley, believe that when it comes to art, the proof should be in the pudding? Or do you think that an artist's plans and motivations for their work affect its meaning? Artistic interpretation is a complex web that will probably never offer a definitive answer.
Art crosses the boundaries of societies and history and answers this very big question. How do we define beauty in art? If you look at any dictionary or encyclopedia of the past two centuries and look for the definition aesthetics, you will find a classic definition that aesthetics is the study of beauty and art. Beauty is not only something that we are all familiar with, and not only is it a term that has been constantly used from ancient times until today, but it is also something that everyone desires and respects. Its history is complex. Many, even today, wonder and seek answers to the following questions. What is beauty? What is it about an object that makes it beautiful? Is the connection between beauty and art still relevant today, or is it just part of the history of art or the history of beauty? But what if beauty in art concerns our inner self and substance? For instance, my art improves well-being and health is the notion Jota Vorjea depicts when she paints. Born to a family of artists, she started doing art since the age of 4. At the age of 12, she discovered the beauty of the stone, collecting and observing them in every place she visited. Finding beauty everywhere she goes. But her art goes beyond that. She believes that through the power of the stone, she brings therapeutic elements to her art. And her purpose is through her art to bring therapeutic healing and raising of vibration to people's souls. Hello, Jota, and welcome to our program.
Hello, thank you for inviting me, Katerina.
Now, I would like to begin by asking you, what is art for you?
Art is something that started thousands of years ago, and it was a need for the people to do. Art is something that is a big part in our lives, and is a creative expression that is communicated with others. So it has the ability to communicate with everyone. It has to communicate with everyone, no matter who this person is, and we can find art everywhere. So for me, to me, is something that it's a combination of beauty, it's a combination of aesthetics, of techniques, of skills, and it has to communicate with everyone.
Speaking of beauty, where can we find beauty?
We can find beauty everywhere, especially I truly believe that nature is beautiful. So if we start to be present, we start to see the beauty around us. If you are not present, you cannot see the beauty. So it's a matter of how we feel to find the beauty around us. We have to be practiced to start doing that. There are people that say that their day is not good enough, not beautiful enough, or the person around them, the people around them, are not that nice, not that beautiful, or maybe he doesn't have this connection with others. I see beauty everywhere, and I do that because I am present. So to find the beauty, there are three factors that have to be fulfilled. And one is the mind, the eye, and the heart. The mind has to do with the aesthetics, the forms and the shapes that you see around you. And then it's the eye. We usually say, this is an eye candy. My eye is pleased, is satisfied. And then we have the heart, that there is something that you don't see, but you feel. And it has to do with the colors and the light.
Is art always beautiful? I mean, there are some times when we see something which can be shocking, for example, and it's also art, isn't it?
Actually, the last 150 years, People believe that art is everything. It's a creative expression. Art has to be something that elevates the spirit. So if you can do that, and your art doesn't have to be just representational, and it has to be in every art. There are so many art movements around. I mean, after the shocking Dadaism, where you can do everything, everything was art. I mean, every expression, creative or not, was art. And that was after the First World War, when people were very angry about the things that had happened, and they felt like pawns, and that I can do everything. I can be funny, I can be silly, and this is art. If you can communicate that and you can make people happy with what you're doing, then yes, this is art.
And is art for everyone?
The question has two answers. If art is for everyone, and we're talking about the creator and the receiver, the audience, yes, it is for everyone. So when a child creates and the outcome is good enough, so the child can communicate the message, even it is the beauty, a landscape, a seascape, a person, a portrait, and people find this beautiful, then this is art. Now, everybody can do art because everybody has the need to express themselves. Again, if art is for everyone, the receiver has to be ready to receive the message that has to be communicated. So the receiver has to be present to receive that message. Because if we are lost in things that are happening around us, and actually if we are lost in the past or in the future, then we cannot receive the message.
But there's a fine line between art and, let's say, great art, because sometimes there is a distinction. We all make art, but at the same time, sometimes we wonder, why is this work of art there and another isn't?
I believe it's a matter of marketing.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, nowadays it plays a crucial role. Marketing and how you brand your art.
I was looking with great interest into your profile. And the reason I chose you is because the show, Infinitely Curious, the program, is very close to having an exploration into our inner self. And this year will be 20 years since you started painting. First, what triggered your passion in art? And why do you place so much importance on earth, energy, and well-being?
Okay, Katerina, that's a great question. What triggered me to start painting the element of stone? So let me tell you a story. When I was 12, one day my parents decided, my family decided to have a trip at Loutraki, which is a seaside area. And it was the first time that I felt this energy of the stones, of the pebbles. They were all shiny and smooth. So I decided to take some of them in our car, and bring them back home. So the following week, I was painting those pebbles. And when it was Sunday again, next weekend, I asked my parents that I wanted to give those paintings to strangers under the Acropolis. So we went to Acropolis and I started to connect with other people and to give them those paintings on the pebbles. And I always had a message on the other side. I don't know what made me do that, but I felt that I wanted to connect the energy of the stones with other people because I could truly receive this energy, but I didn't know if other people could. So there were many people, I was only 12, so there were many people around me. It was just my sister and I. I was 12, she was 10. I was painting in front of the strangers and of the passersby, and then I was giving those pebbles. And I felt so happy that I did this for an entire year. Every Sunday I was there. I heard many stories from other people that they loved the energy of the stone, of this element, and that they pick up from the beach and they have a collection. So I realized that I'm not the only one. Many years passed And in my 20s, I had an experience that made me start this series of paintings, of stone paintings. It was a beautiful afternoon of July. I was in my 20s. And I was with my husband. And I love the beach cliffs. And I was at Lemos, Vouliagmen, in Lemos. I was there on the cliffs, and we loved to dive from the cliffs because it is an unbelievable experience when you do that. And we did that, and the sun was shining. It was setting, actually, but it was gold at this hour. And we were diving and then climbing up the cliffs and then diving again, and we did that many times. And as we were doing that, I felt very connected. I was again present and happy and elevated, and all was good. And suddenly, my mind flew and I started to feel guilty about my laziness, let's say. I should be back home having... I was an art director in a publication company. So I had to work on some projects. I had to prepare the work for my team. I had to do this and that. So I was in the past, I was in the future at the same time.
And not in the present.
So I was regretting that I was there. So I said to myself, let's have a last dive and let's go back. And I did that. So as I was climbing up for my last dive, it was something that I cannot describe, but I felt like an energy, like a power pushing me against the rock. So I let my hands go and I saw myself floating. And I said to myself, okay, this is my last moment. And I looked at the sun and I said, okay, I'm going to die now. I'm going to die now and let this be my last view. But, you know, it is also the conscious mind that tries to always to find a way to survive. So I also did an inverted jump, and then I dove in the water. I have a scar on my thigh, and I am alive, so I survived, of course. But I have this
bad... You slipped.
I don't know what happened. I felt that an energy pushing me against. And that's why I just let my hands off the rock.
Okay, I see. So somebody was pushing you towards the water then?
Yes.
Something was pushing you towards the water.
I don't know what was that. I don't know, but I felt that. I'm sure that I felt that because I just let my hands from the rock. But I did gymnastics when I was younger, I knew how to do an inverted jump, and a few seconds later I was in the water. There were many rocks with, you know, the shell rocks that are above.
Yes,
so those
coral,
the
coral,
coral ones,
yes,
that are very sharp. And that's why I have, some scars on one on my left thigh. But this is my badge of honor, as I said, and I love that because it reminds me. It reminds me to be present. And after that, I was very grateful after that that... I am still alive because the height was enough,
yes,
to not to survive. The same summer I started my paintings. And why was that? Why did I choose the element of stone? A few days later, I was aware of my conscious mind. I always tried to be in the present. So as I was walking at the beach, because I live in Paleofaliro, I was watching at the rock here, at the beach that is full of pebbles. And I love pebbles. I think that every Greek person loves pebbles, and we pick up those pebbles and we have this connection. And I was looking at the pebbles, I realized that I could see stories around me. I could see some arrangements of the stones, of the pebbles, and I could see the big one next to the smaller one. I could see the one with the scars and the other that was smooth. I could see the hidden one, even if it was beautiful, and the other that was not that, you know, shiny and bright was black and above. So I could see some stories, and I started to metaphor stones with people. And then I decided that this is my inspiration.
This was your calling, basically.
This was my calling, yes. And my story was, I think it was...
It's amazing. It's really amazing that a twist of fate, which was not fatal, thank God, you know, made you become who you are today. And that's an incredible story. And thank you actually for sharing it with us. So I guess the earth, the pebbles, and is what brought you life. And this is why you place so much emphasis on well-being.
I believe that when you are present, in the present mode, your well-being is elevated. When we are living in the past, because many people live in the past, we're in the past. We are thinking about what happened yesterday, the day before yesterday, our last, experience that was a month ago, a year ago, our last friend, or we are worrying about the future. What is going to happen? What is going to happen? Am I good enough? Am I going to make it? Am I going to be a good mother? Am I going to be a good wife? Am I going to be a good, employee? Am I going to succeed in this this challenge? We worry and we regret all the time.
And maybe all this doesn't really matter when you actually are in the present. And does painting help you be in the present? When you paint, are you totally in the present?
When I paint, I have to be in the present. If I'm not present, I cannot paint. Actually, what is interesting again is that at my studio, at my art studio, I usually work at nights. So the energy is all mine. I am not distracted by noise that is happening around me, even if this is noise by my happy kids, my three boys that are around me, or my husband, my friends that are coming and visiting me. I cannot do that because my energy is blended with theirs, and I cannot find what I really want to do, what I really want to achieve there. And I really don't know what I'm going to find as I'm painting. I start painting, and this is a journey. But as I am painting, I always intend to work at night, because after 9 o'clock, it is me. Before that, it's not me. I am... Maybe because I also have ADHD, maybe. And I feel that I cannot feel myself. But when I am alone, and always with my headphones and music, I start to paint and I don't know where I'm going to land.
It's some sort of meditation, isn't it?
Yes, it's always.
Do you meditate when you paint?
I meditate when I paint. I let it be. And in the morning, when I have done, I have a process, I have this progress and the process in my painting, there are some people that are coming by to see, and I tell them, never tell me if it is good or not. Never. Because sometimes they change my mind. Even if they tell me that it is nice or not nice. When not nice, I really don't care about what they believe, because I have to get the entire satisfaction, and then I am happy with it to communicate with other people.
Blue as the sky, sunburnt and on me. By the roadside. Don't you let those other boys fool you? Gotta love that afro head.
just more than I could take. Pity for pity's sake. Some nights kept me awake. I thought that I was stronger. When you're gonna realize that you don't even have to try it any longer. Do what you want to, girl, put your records on.
So basically, you communicate your inner beauty through your art, if I understand correctly. And then it's a question of the receiver to accept it, understand it, like it, etc. You chose the stone, which is an integral part of your art, and yet not another element like fire, water, or metal. Why is that? And I'm speaking about those three because you know also I'm a Tai Chi person, you know, and your husband used to teach Tai Chi from mm-hmm. what he told me. And this, I do find that there is an Asian notion about earth and about the power of earth and the power of water and fire. But you chose the pebbles. Why are pebbles so important to you?
As a Greek, I'm very connected to the sea, and I believe that everybody in Greece is connected to the sea. Pebbles are next to the sea. And for me, pebbles have this wisdom. They have seen so many stories happening millions of years ago. So they have these memories. And they exude this wisdom to us. They talk to us. They speak to us. If we're present, we can receive the message, as I said. So this element doesn't try to be the pebbles exactly. Not only the stone, the pebbles. The stone doesn't try to cheat me. It is simple. It is not, for many people, it's not beautiful. It's just a pebble. It's not a crystal. It is not shiny. It is, maybe it is not smooth sometimes.
There's a
maybe.
Deception to shininess. I mean, mm-hmm. and what I find extraordinary, Jordana, I don't know if you agree, is that every pebble is different. It's extraordinary how many pebbles we have in this earth, and they're all unique. Like human beings, like creatures,
you said,
like animals.
You said that.
They're all unique in a certain way, and I find it extraordinary how nature has managed to create all those wonderful little, you know, art creations. They're an art of itself, isn't it?
Ekaterina, you're amazing. I think that you're in my mind. Yeah, pebbles are unique, like us, because each of these pebbles has its own journey, like us. That you cannot find another being that has the same, exactly the same journey as another person. Even if they grew up in the same neighborhood, house, home, and they perceive different experiences or messages from around. So each one of us is different. We are unique. So are the pebbles. That's why I love pebbles so much, because pebbles remind me of the uniqueness of stability, and they are the silent observers of a continuously altered world. They also have the ability to see the sea. They have this connection with the sea, and the sea for me is so different. You can find everything in the sea. I identify with the sea. Sometimes it's calm, other times it's wild. So the sea communicates the story to the pebbles. So the pebbles know. They know more. And the journey is very related to us. We have Odyssey. We have Ulysses. And Ulysses was the one that dared to find value in this journey he had. And as Cavafy said, it's not about the destination. It's about, you know, the journey itself.
And this is art, isn't it?
This is art. This is art. When I had my speech, 2018, I remember I had a speech in Utah. And I talked to them about the journey and about Cavafis. And I read to them the poem of Cavafis. And I had some hundreds of people crying at the same time. So the journey is something that the humanity relates. We are all related with that because we are all on this. We are all one. And we all walk this path, and we don't know where we're going to what point are we going to reach. So if we are aware, present, then we will manage to be happy every moment.
But you, Yoda, go a step further. Your art seems to also play a very important role in being therapeutic, mm-hmm. as well. You place a lot of emphasis on that, I understand. Mm-hmm. And I know I have a lot of friends who think of pebbles, for example, as being a healing element. Do you agree with that?
Katerina, do you have a pebble at your home?
Of course. I have a whole box of pebbles, yes. Some of them were given by friends. Some of them I found them at the sea. Some of them, there's a friend of mine who actually drew something on them and just gave it to me. Every pebble from the moment I acquired it or that was given to me has obtained a certain kind of history in my mind and in my hands. So it's no longer the same pebble from the moment that I actually picked it up from the beach, or the person who gave it to me picked it up from the beach. So yeah, I think every time I go to the beach, I try to search for the right pebble for me. Because I guess it's a question of personality. I think that every pebble has a certain kind of personality.
Perfect.
Or not.
Yes, you said it. So why I use pebbles and why do I find them therapeutical? Why I use them in my paintings? So my subject matter is the pebbles, the stones, and water, actually. Sometimes I have the pebbles immersed underwater, and there are those reflections above the water, the light that is playing and is dancing on the water, and you cannot see that if you are not present, right? So when I am walking at the seaside and I see those pebbles immersed, I have to be present to do that. So at this exact moment, my well-being is fulfilled, is happy. My inner self is happy. And let me talk to you about this. Sometimes we are talking about our higher self. And who is that? Where is this? Where is he? Where is she? So I look against the mirror and I see myself. And is this my higher self? Is it not? I'm wondering. So it's not what we see against the when we are looking at, you know, against the mirror, where we are against the mirror. It is what we feel inside us. And we can feel what our higher self, some people say it's about the soul, we can feel our higher self when it's happy. Our higher self is always happy. When you feel sad, that means that you are not connected with your higher self, because you are here. You are here on earth to experience happiness.
Or not. Or sometimes even sadness is a process.
It's
sometimes
a process.
Sometimes we have to let sadness.
Let sadness
be.
Yeah, because no? the only way out is through. So we to overcome a difficulty, we have to go through the sadness, the sorrow, what is happening, and then this is, sometimes it is, it heals us. It makes us stronger. So the pebbles on the beach, when I walk at the beach, you can see everything that is very simple. Every day I walk at the beach, every day. So I start my day with this ritual. It's my routine. When I walk at the beach I walk to the beach and I stay there for at least half hour. And when I am there, I can see that all my problems are solved. All my problems. I see, you know, the problem that I had the previous day in the evening, because in the evening it's not good to feel things or to take some decisions, to make some decisions. The next day when I walk at the beach, everything looks so simple, so simple. You can see the perspective and the scale of the problems is ridiculous. I can find... because I'm present, because I can see that this was not that important, this was not that difficult. So I find solutions for everything when I am there. And when I represent the paintings, the pebbles on the paintings, then I give this tool, this reminder to the viewers to experience well-being through my eyes.
Are there people who come to you and say they do not understand your art, or that they're very emotional about your art? I mean, because there are people who actually we relate to. When you paint, I understand that there are people who relate to you and therefore to your art, and there are people who just don't get it, right?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I don't remember somebody that came to me telling me that they don't understand my art. Maybe these people avoid me, maybe. But what I have experienced is that people come to me and very emotional, and they tell me that they understand. And when they do that, I feel that I have reached my goal.
Same
frame of mind. Let me tell you something about this short story. When I was living in the US, I posted on Facebook a new painting, a fresh on the easel, and it was a broken heart. Called this painting a broken heart. It was a stone that was red, that it was at the center, and all around this red stone there were many pebbles around the stone, but this red stone had also a crack, and it looked like, you know, like a heart, but not that much, but it had a crack, and it was called a broken heart. A couple of hours later, a lady from Canada said that I want to acquire this one, and this has to be mine. I asked her, why? What's your story? Because people have a story. When they relate to my paintings, they have a story, and they are connected with my story. So she said that she had, a couple of months ago, she had a very bad experience. It was snowing in Canada, and you know that snow there is a lot, it's hard. So she slipped under her huge truck, and nobody could find her. And it was snowing hard and harder and harder. So nobody could find her, and she was there. And because she had a panic attack, she had a broken heart syndrome that... It was like a heart attack, but it was a syndrome, but it had the same symptoms. So after that, she said that she wanted to have this one to remind her of what she had experienced. So my first question to her was, are you going to remember your panic every day with this painting? I said, no, I just want to remember that I won at this challenge. And I told her that now, if you have this painting, you may have this crack, but your heart is going to be hard as a stone. If you don't feel that, and you feel and you experience again and again this panic that you had, then it's not a painting for you. So I have to make sure that the receiver, the buyer of my paintings, elevates and uplifts their heart and soul when they have their art in their space. It's very important to me. Otherwise, I feel that my purpose is not fulfilled.
Having said that, I always think of pebbles that are changing. Like the pebbles who are in the water have a different color, and when you actually pick them out of the water, they change and they're in the sun and then they have a different, completely different color. Aristotle says the aim of art is to represent not the outward appearance of things, but their inward significance. Having said that about pebbles changing, do you think of that inward significance when you create your art, or you just aim to please yourself first, regardless of what the audience will think?
To start working on a painting, I have to please myself. Otherwise, I won't be authentic. Mm-hmm. If I don't see a story in the painting, my story in the painting, if I don't feel connected with what I am painting, and that's why I'm painting in the nights, to have the entire experience mine, then I cannot complete this one. And when I do that, people that see that my paintings can receive the message. If I am not authentic, then they will not receive it. So there are people, I know artists, that are wondering, maybe at their first steps, first years, that are wondering, what would other people like? I think that they would like me to paint this or that. And I always advise them, just do what you love, and there will be at least one person that will connect with you, relate with you, resonate, and feel what you want to give. We have to be authentic, otherwise it won't last long. We will be dissatisfied in a very short term, and then we will give up. Because actually what we are paid is our feelings.
Yoda Voria, thank you very much for taking the time to come here to Art Studios and the Voice of Greece to speak to us. And I think it has been a really rewarding conversation about, not about only art, but about our inner self, which is what I think is most important in this life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Katerina. It was a pleasure.
Not trying to be in there. Not trying to be cool, just trying to be in this. Tell me how you do. Can you feel where the wind is? Can you feel it through all of the windows inside this room? 'Cause I wanna touch you, baby, and I wanna feel you too. I wanna see the sunrise and your sins just being you. Light it up on the run. Let's make love tonight. Make
these questions about art point to the complexity of the issue of beauty. It is a category that has been defined in many different ways throughout history. Umberto Eco says that beauty was never something absolute and unchanging, but depending on the historical period and the country, it embodied different features. So the nature of the concept of beauty is something fluid and ever-changing, something whose definition has constantly changed over the years.
In ancient Greece and Rome, the category of beauty is often equated with the unity of beauty and goodness. According to Plato, it is not only objects, forms, colours or sounds that can be beautiful, but also thoughts, customs, characters and even laws. Thus, the category of beautiful is transferred from the field of aesthetics to the field of ethics as well. But as early as the 5th century BC, the Sophists opposed this interpretation of beauty and proposed a much narrower, sensualist understanding of beauty. According to them, what is pleasant to the sight and hearing is beautiful. In this way, the beautiful is distinguished from the good and is understood exclusively aesthetically. Thomas Aquinas said in his Summa Theologiae that what is pleasing when perceived is beautiful. The unification of beauty and art was most clearly and strongly made in the Renaissance. This is evidenced by the treatise on painting by Leonardo da Vinci, which distances the crafts from the arts and brings art closer to the sciences. This unification lasted for a long time in aesthetics, from the beginning of the construction of the concept of fine arts as opposed to crafts until the beginning of the 20th century. What has been said so far about beauty was partly also a characterization of art, because for a long time art was defined only as beautiful art. However, the phrase fine arts was used for the first time in the 16th century by the Portuguese Francesco de Holanda, also in Portuguese known as Boas Artes. Still, it was only widely accepted in the middle of the 18th century when the French philosopher Abbot Charles Barthes published his work The Beautiful Arts Reduced to One Principle, or in French, Les Beaux-Arts Réduits à un même principe. From this work, the name fine arts solidified itself and becomes generally accepted, thus building the modern notion of art. The beautiful arts, says Barthes, exists because their purpose is to give us pleasure. The connection between beauty and art is apparent, and the fact that there is a certain connection between the two is indisputable. Beauty is the defining characteristic and determinant that makes art what is, and this is the first definition we have of art. A different definition of art, one that might be as old as the first one we've already mentioned, is of art as form. Since the time of the Pythagoreans, philosophers have been trying to demonstrate that beauty is an objective category, and hence that the beauty of the world, of the cosmos, is something that mostly depends on numerical relationships. The Pythagoreans constantly emphasize harmony as something of the highest value, and when they talk about harmony, they actually mean harmony over order, order over proportion, proportion over measure, and measure over number. That is why the categories of proportion, symmetry, harmony, and rhythm are relevant to these theories of art. As the Polish aesthetician Tatarkiewicz points out, under the influence of the Pythagoreans and per their theory, the Greeks began to call beauty symmetria or proportionality.
You're never going out of style. Ooh, pretty baby, this world might have gone crazy. The way you save me, who could blame me when I just wanna make you smile? I wanna do you like Michael. I wanna kiss you like Prince. Let's get it all like Marvin, yeah, like Hathaway. Write a song for you like this. You're over my head, I'm out of my mind. Thinking I was cool. Wrong time, one of a kind, living in a world gone plastic. Baby, you're so classic. Baby, you're so classic.
The theory of art as imitation, mimesis, has its roots in pre-Homeric times. Art was taken to be the imitation or expression of inner feelings during religious acts, especially during dancing, mimicry, and singing within the framework of Orphic and Dionysian cults and festivities. So we can state that the theory of imitation begins as a kind of theory of expression.
In the 5th century BC, the expression imitation passed from the language of cult and religion into the world of philosophy and science with the philosophy of Democritus. We drink, says Democritus, by imitating the singing of birds. We weave by imitating the spider's web. We build dwellings by imitating the building of bird nests, and so forth. However, the complete formation of this theory in antiquity occurs with Plato and Aristotle. Plato's philosophy of art derives in a necessary way from his metaphysics. Plato placed the world of art in last place, just below the world of ideas and the world of materiality. The world of ideas is the only truly existing world. It is perfect, eternal, and one. The world of materiality, says Plato, is a copy or shadow of the world of ideas. As a consequence, the world of art is a copy of the world of materiality, or simply said, a copy of the copy. Since nature is a copy of the ideas, a landscape would be a copy of the copy. Therefore, Plato does not value the world of art very highly in his system. Imitation, he says, is only a passive repetition of reality. A faithful copying is not a proper way to reach the truth. Although Plato saw imitation as something completely negative, Aristotle took the opposite view. According to Aristotle, art is not only a bare copying of reality, but it is always an introduction of something new. It is also an interpretation of the world. For Aristotle, imitation is positive and represents a free action of the artist in relation to reality. He even extends its meaning from the realm of the visual arts to the realms of music, dance, and literature. The theory of mimesis underwent significant changes in the Middle Ages with the philosophy of St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. They understand imitation as imitating the divine in nature or God himself within a mystical and religious discourse, as mimesis theou, or as imitatio Dei. Therefore, St. Thomas Aquinas, the great medieval Aristotelian, supports the thesis that art imitates nature. In the Renaissance, imitation again became a fundamental concept of art and art theory, and this is confirmed by the fact that from the 15th to the 18th century, the term imitatio became the most commonly used term, both in relation to the visual arts and in relation to art overall. The theory of mimesis experienced its peak with the publication of Charles Barth's book, The Fine Arts Reduced to a Single Principle, in 1747. In the book, imitation is defined as the main principle of the unification of the fine arts.
Got a soul. Believe me, I will use them both. We made a start, be it a false one, I know. Baby, I don't want to feel alone. So kiss me where I lay down, my hands pressed to your cheeks, a long way from the playground. I have loved you since we were 18, long before we both thought the same thing, to be loved, to be in love.
Art in the field of aesthetics has never had a static, clear, and unambiguous definition. It has a fluid nature, as can be gathered from the evolution that it went through throughout the years. Each thinker came up with their own position on the question of what art is, and each of them emerged with an original theory, making the whole discussion even more rich and complex. There are, of course, other more contemporary approaches and theories about the topic of defining art. The question of what art is remains open to this day, and a lot of new theories will likely emerge in the future. But what is clear is that art evokes feelings, and when feelings are there, then art is there. I'm Katerina Badzaiki. Join us next week in another of our Infinite Curious programs of Earth and the Voice of Greece. Meanwhile, as Pablo Picasso says, art washes from the soul the dust of everyday life. And if that happens to your soul, then you know it is art indeed.